This is Words First, talking text in opera. I'm Keturah Stickan. Good morning, everyone. I'm speaking to you from my 17th floor condo in downtown San Diego, on a morning off from rehearsing for San Diego Opera's drive-in Bohème. More on that in a bit. First, I'd like to give a couple of updates on programs and people who have appeared on this podcast in the past 4 months. A few weeks ago, I spoke to Mark Straschensky, the artistic director of West Edge Opera, about a new program that West Edge was starting called Aperture. It is a membership-based program that allows members to view short videos from librettist and composer teams as they put together new work, and then allows the members to vote on which teams they want to see move forward to the next round of work. Aperture has officially released their collaborative teams, and they include a number of people who have appeared on this podcast. Mark Campbell, who is working on My Own Country with Kamala Shankaram, Lila Palmer, who is working on The Battle of Atlanta with Damian Jeter, Royce Vavrick, who is working on The Pope's Jews with Yotam and Anna Schuheit Hager, Stephanie Fleischman, who is working with Matthew Recio on L'Autre Moi, and working on Seven Sisters with Justine F. Chen and Anya Ogawa, and John de los Santos, who is joined once again by Clint Borzoni for Niceville. They are among a group of 22 teams who members can follow on their writing journey. I encourage you to check it out at aperture.westedgeopera.org. Hopefully, I'll have a chance to speak to more of these librettists and creators in my next season. I also want to remind folks that the Decameron Opera Coalition has begun releasing their serial, Tales from a Safe Distance. The first 3 episodes have been released, and the 4th comes out at the end of this week, which includes Sourdough Rise Up by Jill DeLyons, whom I interviewed a few weeks ago. If you don't have tickets yet, I urge you to get them. You can watch episodes as they are released, but they'll also be available on demand to ticket holders until the end of the year. So, about this Bohème I'm working on. By the time you hear this, it will have opened, and it's been a crazy adventure of socially distanced performing, outdoor theater building, and contending with blustery conditions near the bay, speaking into god mics with a mask on, and all of the other trials that come with making live performance in this era. One of those things, the fact that the singers can't come within 15 feet of each other, has forced me to look at the text of this opera in a different way. How do we portray Kejalida Manina when there's no physical way to know if her hand is actually cold? I decided to set it all in memory. I put Rodolfo in the future looking back at the events leading up to Mimi's death. I turned Mimi into a ghost, both haunting him and helping him to let go of the guilt and grief that he was feeling at her demise. All of the singers jumped into the concept with me, and what we really got out of this was the malleability of text. The fact that so much of what the characters of Rodolfo and Mimi say to each other in the piece can be turned around, can be placed in slightly different context, and yet can still tell the story. The emotional tale has not been altered, the way we tell it has. For instance, in Act 3, Rodolfo tells Marcello, "Per richiamarla in vita non basta amor. Love is not enough to bring her back to life." By facing this literally, Rodolfo is speaking to himself about very real grief. We were shocked at how many phrases and conversations could skew in this direction, and how easily the story could be told from this angle. I've never reconstituted a text in this way, and it's been an incredible exercise in balancing the librettist and composer's intent with the imposed restrictions of performance practice at this time. One of my singers told me that they'd learned more about this character they've portrayed so many times simply by re-examining the text like this, and so the experiment feels useful and big. I'm feeling thankful for text analysis right now. Today's interview is with playwright, director, and librettist Jerry Dye. Even in this time of restricted performance, Jerry has been busy. He worked with Francis Pollock this summer to create an a cappella piece for each young artist at Chautauqua Opera, based on conversations he and Francis had with them. He also has 2 shows in Chicago Opera Theater's virtual season. One is Past, the transformation of Jane Doe with Stacey Garop, and the other, Taking Up Serpents with Kamala Shankaram, is on in the spring. Jerry calls himself a story collector, as so much of his work comes from field interviews about his subjects, which he collects and turns into theater. We'll go into depth about his process, as well as his relationship with the truth, as he transforms these collected tales into musical storytelling. Take a listen. Jerry, welcome to Words First. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
So happy to be here.
I'm glad. So you're from the South, and you live in Chicago. And I'm from Chicago, and I live in the South. So I just thought that was an interesting little, you know, back and forth.
Nice.
So, 'cause I'm in Knoxville, Tennessee, and you're from Mississippi?
Oh, wow.
Is that
yeah,
right?
born in Mississippi and raised in Mississippi and also in Tennessee. So
that's right.
Do you know, are you aware of a little town called Cleveland, Tennessee?
I am aware of Cleveland, Tennessee.
People usually stop there for gas on the way to Knoxville.
Nice. So how long have you been in Chicago?
Let's see. Probably about 8 years, I think.
Okay. That's a nice amount
assessment.
Of time. That's how long I lived in Chicago.
Yeah, yeah. I was told I had to wait 10 years to be an official Chicagoan, so I'm on my way.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It depends on where you are. My family's, the whole family's from Chicagoland, so, you know, you have your Chicago purists, and then you have your Chicagoans that say, well, I'm from Chicago, but you're not actually from Chicago. But it's 10 years is probably about right. That's probably right.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
So is that where your career started? I know it's not, but I just talk to me a little bit about your playwright. I know you've done some work in Memphis, quite a bit of work in Memphis.
Sure.
Can you just tell me a little bit about how you learned everything you know?
Well, I'm an artist, so I'm a bit of a vagabond. So I've basically lived just about all of the places. I've lived in New York. I lived in San Francisco. I lived in L.A., Chicago, and right before Chicago, I was in Memphis for a while. I was the artistic director of a theater company there.
Fantastic.
But I've kind of done my time in every major city. You know, you mentioned I was born and raised in Mississippi. I'm from Tupelo and Amory. They're tiny little towns, and you know, Tupelo's the birthplace of Elvis, the King of Rock and Roll. So I keep on telling people I'm on the Elvis tour. So I don't know if I'll be living in Vegas, but.
Right. That would be the next choice. Yeah. I don't know how I would feel about that. So
me either.
Having lived in San Diego and spent a lot of time in Vegas, I don't know. So you just opened, which is such a strange word during this period of online performances, but you just opened the transformation of Jane Doe at Chicago Opera Theater, which,
we did.
By the way, got just a terrific review today from the Chicago Tribune, and you wrote it with Stacey Garup?
Yeah, Garup.
And you based it on a true sort of myth about a woman who haunts the Drake Hotel in Chicago, which I actually am familiar with whole story. But do you dig the film noir 1920s murder mystery vibe? Is that like something?
Me?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, here's the deal. I'm a straight up movie freak. So like, give me a movie and let me disappear for a while. It's like, in fact, during COVID times, that's been my crutch.
Has it?
Yeah. Falling headlong into, you know, doing the deep dive into Amazon Prime and finding all the relics. And I, you know, I'm one of those high-low people. And I, you know, give me a fabulous art film, but also give me the trash too. So yeah. I love it. I love it. Yeah. That was definitely the inspiration for one of the jumping off places, the inspiration for the piece with Stacey, which we definitely wanted to write something that was about Chicago itself.
Right. Well, she's also from Chicago.
She is.
Yeah.
She is.
Great.
And she's part of the Vanguard program at Chicago Opera Theater, which is, you know, an amazing institution, amazing group of people. I was lucky enough to be chosen by Stacey to jump in on a project together. We had wrote a short piece first, and then that is an independent project from the full length, but it ended up, we loved the small project so much that we kind of expanded it.
That's great.
The city of Chicago is filled with stories, especially obviously, you know, 1920s, the turn of the century right there, boom.
Oh, I know. Just, it's Chicago, right, at its worst and best all at the same time.
Strange and beautiful and so much tumult and just And there's just every, you can't be in downtown Chicago without experiencing the era, you know, the era. It's just, yeah. It's just completely in the DNA.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So we knew we wanted to do something about that. And we actually ended up setting it, oddly enough, a portion of it in the place where we ended up doing this performance that you're talking about, this virtual.
Was it at the Studebaker?
At the Studebaker.
Yeah, it's in that gorgeous old building.
It is great. Yeah. And we rehearsed upstairs too, the fine arts building. Yeah. So you just, everywhere you go, it just feels kind of haunted and beautiful.
It's ancient and it does.
Yeah. Mysterious elevator.
You can feel the old energy that's floating around in there. I remember when the Studebaker was a film house. When I was in college, it was you could go and watch.
Really? So I missed that part. Yeah, that makes me sad. I would have loved that.
Yeah, it was very cool.
You know, like the rest of us, I think we've been held up for so long in our homes, and me especially. Mm-hmm. I was pretty much living at home 24/7, and so heading back into the rehearsal room was very interesting. Oh, it was really kind of amazing. And the pandemic procedures and the distancing and the mask and watching singers sing in those masks, God bless them. Oh, all, everyone, all the way through this process. I really was so impressed with COT and how they scaled this. So we did a four camera shoot with Valhalla Media of the piece with the full orchestra,
which is so cool. What they're doing, Valhalla Media. I mean, I'm so happy that CRT got in bed with them, because I think it's a great marriage.
They're good people too. They're good in the room too, which is a big thing for me. Peace and love. Damn it.
Please. Can you talk to me about being a librettist versus being a playwright, and how hard was your transition from one mental space to the other?
The transition from one mental space to the other was apples and oranges.
Yeah, but,
in many, many ways. Now, clearly one brings what one brings into the room, and that is all beneficial and plays out in strange and mysterious ways. But, a few years, so let's see, it was in 2000. So I have not been in the opera world all that long. Mm-hmm. In about 2013, I suppose, 12 or 13, the artistic director was living in Memphis, Tennessee at the time. And the artistic director of Opera Memphis, Ned Canty, who is a great guy and just does some wonderful, innovative stuff. He's one of the people that I remain amazed with along the way, taking lots of risks and figuring out how to kind of get opera into new audiences. So there was a old building in downtown Memphis that had been derelict for decades. And it was a big behemoth, a mammoth thing. It was an old Sears distribution center.
Yep.
And it was essentially like a city. I mean, it was just huge. And it was empty. And a bunch of concerned citizens came together and said, what if we re-envisioned this building instead of, turning it into some, Memphis Disneyland? We could actually do something meaningful with it. Mm-hmm. Make it a center for arts. Make it create galleries, create affordable housing, everything from affordable health care, you name it. And they kind of dreamed up this building. And one of the first steps in making it happen is they reached out to artists in town and said, can you make art about this space? Mm-hmm. So I had been working, I've always done kind of story collecting as part of one of the things I have in my kitty.
Okay.
And story gathering, working in communities that way, developing compiled scripts from with human beings. And Ned reached out to me and said, hey, would you be interested in collecting stories around this building, which is called Crosstown, and turning those stories into a series of monodramas? So it was four monodramas.
Okay.
And I think also maybe five monologues as well. And And it was, I had this wonderful crash course where I was instantaneously working with composers in opera and at the same time. So, So I was having this little wonderful mini grad school where I was doing this dance with my four composers and kind of learning on the job.
It's kind of amazing, right? Like, I think sometimes there's something about artists and both learning the hard way, but also just jumping with both feet into the fire, you know, when something is interesting. Yeah. I always find it fascinating when I talk to people who make a pivot in what they're doing. And and 9 times out of 10, that's how they do it. They just leap off the cliff. So it's really wonderful. Yeah.
You know, it was such a joy. And then oddly enough, it premiered. All of those pieces were performed in the building. Mm-hmm. There wasn't even electricity in the building yet. So the audience traveled around the building with flashlights and kind of encountered these pieces throughout the building, which was lovely. So it was also a great site-specific event too, which is stuff that I adore. Mm-hmm. And then those pieces, at least two of those four pieces, ended up being kind of calling cards for me and were chosen as part of the New Work Sampler for Opera America.
Yeah.
So the next thing I knew, I'm like, oh, I'm in these new worlds and these new rooms, having new conversations with people I had never dreamed with before.
One of those was Abandoned, is that correct? Composed by Cameron Ince?
Yeah, totally.
I read about, because I was reading about Ghosts of Crosstown, and I read that that piece was written to be sung by the building itself, according to some of the press releases. How was it writing sort of in that way, instead of, especially you talk about compiling people stories, like what was it writing for the story of a building itself, or something that we usually consider inanimate?
Well, you know, so many people had a fondness for this building. So when I was collecting words and phrases and pieces and parts, I was amazed that folks had such feeling for this space, whether it was, you know, a love story that happened to them when they were, you know, in the 1960s, when they met their wife, or whether it was a 14-year-old kid that busted out a window and crawled inside to go smoke pot and drink Boone's Farm and Owl at the Moon. So it was like all the stories were, you kind of had to at some point make the building itself have a voice. And also with in the collecting of the stories ended up being a bit a joy, because I ended up probably with 24 concepts that I then sent to all the composers. And so the composers really got to choose which one they felt most attached to. And so we developed it from there.
Nice. And that was you said that was in 2016?
And they saw the light of day in 14 and 15.
Okay.
Yeah. And then there, of course, there have been subsequent productions of them.
There have been subsequent. Where else has it been performed?
See, Yvonne was at Opera America at the Sampler 1 year. The next year, Abandon was another year. Yvonne was with Nathaniel Stuckey. Okay. And then that piece has been done by West Edge.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Yeah. And then one of the composers on the piece was Zach Redler.
Okay.
Who's ended up being one of my primary collaborators over the past, since that moment.
Right. Yeah, you've worked quite a bit.
Yeah.
Speaking of Zach Redler, and also sort of field interviews or collecting stories, I want to talk about The Falling and the Rising, which you wrote for the U.S. Army Field Band Chorus, and then had a bunch of co-producing companies, I think, with that. And that was that was with Zachary Redler.
It was.
Did you do the field interviews yourself for that piece?
We did. Mm-hmm. So this was the brainchild of a guy named Ben Hilgert. He's with the U.S. Army Field Band and Chorus. And so he had the idea, you know, what if we did some story collection? And again, happened to be sitting in the audience when Yvonne was performed. And he said, can someone introduce me to that guy? So the next thing I know, we're kind of making plans and provisions to head out. The army provided amazing access to soldiers at Walter Reed, and at various bases.
Wow!
Whether it was in person or online or, you know, via Skype at the time. And and so we collected stories about specifically around the idea of soldiers coming home from war, what that was like for them and what that was like for their families. And then created The Falling and the Rising, which was multiple characters. And each character was kind of a composite sketch of all of the interviews that we did. So, yeah, each character held, you know, between two to a dozen different interviews that we did over a few month period. And then that piece is, you know, because of the co-commission, which I'm so grateful for.
Seriously.
It's really made the rounds, you know?
Yeah. Well, it sounds like an important piece too. I mean, I think just getting these stories of people who've gone through these things and come home from them, it's an incredibly American story.
Massive learning experience.
I'll bet. What's your relationship with truth in your writing? How much do you like writing people's truths versus making up stories? And then when you are writing somebody's truth, how much poetic license do you find yourself taking?
Yeah. You know, different scenarios call for different structures. Uh-huh. But, you know, in that situation, all of the story ideas, you know, the individual characters, the ideas came from the interviews themselves. But then the language was then, and sometimes the idiosyncratic language was peppered in throughout the arias or the scene work. But then, you know, I'm working on a project. Do you know Frances Pollack?
Yes, Frances. Yes, I know Frances pretty well.
She's freaking awesome.
Yes.
And I've been, well, you know, well, through Chautauqua. So,
well, yeah.
I've been working on the song cycle with Frances at Chautauqua. And, you know, those are, in that situation, they're definitely completely verbatim phrases and just kind of adaptation, a rearranging of the thoughts and a compression of the conversation itself.
I was actually going to ask you about
this. Oh, sorry.
You're fine. I'm glad you brought it up because it's you did your own segue. Very nice. So you were commissioned to write this libretto for a series of short a cappella pieces. Just for some context, so Chautauqua, of course, like so many companies, went completely online this summer. And so these young artists are all sitting in their houses and you can't really get together and make a piece that has instruments. It's easier to just have them be a cappella. But each of these pieces seemed so unbelievably personal, and you did actually spend time talking and interviewing these young artists in order to take the material that made up these pieces. Is that how it kind of went?
Yeah. So Frances and I sat in Zoom. Thank goodness for Zoom.
Thank goodness for Zoom.
I don't know what I would do without it.
Right.
Each interview was about an hour long, and it was just an open-ended discussion about, you know, where are you right now? What's life like for you right now? And like you said, because of the Young Artist Program being slightly different, you know, everyone was remote and everyone was in their own space. And, you know, you have singers that are just, you know, were about to head into a production that they had been working on for so long and so excited about. And suddenly they find themselves in their parents' basement.
Right.
You know, we had one amazing singer who is from Wuhan and she wasn't able to go home. So she's like stuck in Jersey City, looking at New York across the way and, you know, imagining what's going on with her folks.
Right.
So the stories, you know, I it's endless.
Mm-hmm.
I've turned into a bit of an evangelical around this process, because I do think it's a kind of a bridge for a new audience in a way that it's really exciting to me.
Well, I've been you know, I've been thinking a lot about the American canon of opera, just how we have to develop it, and there was just a Opera America just had a panel on inherited works, and I'm thinking, okay, well, so much of what we have is inherited works, but we're writing our own works now, and I think the only way to create a true American opera canon is to tell our own stories. Where you're going with this is just this notion of continually just collecting all these stories of people's lives and people's experiences that are in America, and when you're setting that to music, you're creating just in and of itself an American opera canon simply by telling the stories of the American people. I think that's really beautiful.
Yeah, and not to sound overly crunchy, but you know, it also feels the process feels like I've been referring to it as like the circle of generosity. You know. Mm-hmm. We all sit, we are all in the room, mm-hmm. albeit virtual. We're all in the room. We're all agreeing to be there. We're all listening. Mm-hmm. And then I walk away, I rearrange and putter and futz and make something hopefully that feels authentic to that moment. I hand it over to the composer. Then the composer hands it back to the singer. And then the singer is actually singing their own language and offering it up to the audience. So, mm-hmm. It's just like, it's like this gorgeous, good thing.
Yes.
And I don't know about you.
Yeah.
But these days, my friend.
Gorgeous good things are hard to come
by.
I
need more gorgeous good things.
We do. Do you consider, especially when talking about doing this sort of work, how personal do you find your work to be? Do you bring yourself to these pieces that you write?
Sure.
Or do you step outside of yourself?
In the straight up interview situations like this, I definitely have to step back, uh-huh. you know, uh-huh. because I feel like the pieces themselves are their portraiture, and yeah, and it's not just a portrait of the person; it's actually a portrait of the conversation in
right.
a way. So I really do have to kind of step back from that. Uh-huh. But you know, in other situations, I definitely throw myself into the work. The piece with Kamala.
I was see. Look, you're creating
sorry. Am I
segueing
again?
You're a step ahead of me, man. This is like amazing.
You're
yeah.
just a good question asker.
Okay. So how personal is Taking Up Serpents that you wrote with Kamala Shankaram?
There's definitely a vein of family narrative in there, certainly. Uh-huh. It's certainly created from a whole cloth, but yeah, it's definitely personal. I grew up in, like we said, Mississippi, and there was this brief but amazing window of time where my folks were part of a kind of a grassroots evangelical, you know, a non-denominational church, mm-hmm. you know, complete with tambourines and speaking in tongues.
Awesome.
And healings and the whole nine yards. And I was just young enough to be amazed mm-hmm. because I was seeing my next door neighbors and, you know, Jane and Joe Schmo, mm-hmm. who, you know, I've been over to their house. I've eaten their tuna fish casserole.
Right.
You know, I played in their backyard. These essentially didn't seem to me as a kid to be extraordinary people. Uh-huh. But then you enter into that kind of holy space and suddenly people are speaking in prayer language right. and crying and exalting and lifting their arms. It's as a kid, it really taught me something about theater
right.
because and community about how the need to be together in the same room and find something that's feels real
uh-huh.
and ecstatic is fundamental. Mm-hmm. And also that people are just a lot more interesting than they think they are.
I love that.
You know what I mean?
I do.
They really are.
Yeah.
And I encounter over and over again, I encounter people that say, well, yeah, well, I don't have a story to tell, or I don't have anything to, you know, no, not me or whatever, something so awfully self-deprecating. And they're just wrong.
Uh-huh.
The stories lurk in peculiar places. But my mom was very was a leader, I would say, in a lot of ways in that church, as much as a woman could be in that church. And my mother would have been the CEO of a Fortune 500 company had she been born in another state in another time. Right. But she, that world, which she was so deeply invested in love with and leaned on, it only could let her go so far. And I, as a kid, sitting back and watching that was pretty heartbreaking. And my mother actually passed away several years ago. So taking up serpents is like, my mother's so all over that piece.
Yeah.
That feeling of owning your own spiritual journey and not having it be tied to, people, in particular men, and the institutions they make.
Chicago Opera Theater is actually supposed to be doing that as well this season. Is that
That is correct.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
With as it stands right now, with Valhalla again, fully realized though, costumes, props, set, you name it,
fantastic.
But filmed, and I just again, it feels like the great harmonic conjunction. It's like all the things that I love, you know.
Yeah.
Coming together. And I don't know if you know Kamala, but
she is all over the place right now, and I've been reading so much about
her. She's amazing.
And of course, you know, Chautauqua was supposed to do Thumbprint, so I have no doubt that she's amazing just based on what I've read.
And ingenious, like the music is so forward.
Yeah.
It's so forward thinking and exciting and intriguing use of instrumentation.
Oh, that's wonderful. And you've done a couple of things with Kamala.
I have.
Yeah.
I'm ongoing work with her on a VR project.
Right, that's the Parksville Wonders.
Yes, because again, film, and being the horror buffs that we certainly are, definitely with working with her on that, and then a piece at Baldwin Wallace University, and you know, Kamala is one of my absolute people. I have to tell you, all of these composers that I find myself in rooms with, they just keep lifting me up and teaching me something about the craft and about myself. And
so you like the collaboration part of it.
I live for the collaboration part of it. I always say that the writing for a composer is, I tap into like my child self somehow, you know, that feeling of like when you're a kid and you like, you know, make some ridiculous thing out of popsicle sticks for your parents or something and you hand it to them and they smile.
Right.
There's that feeling of like, okay, here's the first draft. What do you think? Like that energy, there's, it cannot be contained. It is, it's so righteous to me. And then figuring out how that unfolds and where that needs to go. And
do you find that you work differently with different composers? Do you cater
completely?
Yeah,
100%.
How long does it take you with a composer to sort of find a rhythm with them usually?
You know what's interesting? Since I've started Kamala's in New York, you know, other people are in Memphis. Jennifer Higdon is in Philly. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone's peppered all throughout the world, so the opportunity to really be in the room with one another is kind of few and far between. So when you do, there for me, there's just this gorgeous window of soaking up that energy and figuring out how where their tastes are, how their brain operates. Composers really are like snowflakes in the best way, in the beautiful sense of a snowflake. They have the uniqueness is pretty intoxicating. Yeah. And like I said, I think it also goes back to my instinct about listening. Mm. It, it, that, that seems to be, right now, it seems to be, the as an artist, it seems to be one of the most profound threads for me. The act of listening and putting it all together.
Wow. Yeah, it sounds like it, just being a story collector. It sounds also like talking to people to create stories or find stories or call stories, but then also to collaborate with people with whom you're writing the art. They feel sort of akin to each other, actually.
Yeah, and I was going to say, though, you know, the piece with Jennifer, what's interesting is, you know, that story, that narrative, you know, Jennifer brought to the table. It was a story that she inspired her, and she was like, hey, what do you think? And, why do you like this story? What is a heist story do for you in this moment? And it was really fun to get to kind of pick her brain. She's also a huge film, film person.
Yes.
It's the cinema. My age is, I am one of the first generation of kids that had home box office. I always call myself, I'm the home box office baby, because my babysitter, we were like the first little neighborhood that I remember. We lived out in the country, but oddly enough, we were the first neighborhood that received cable.
Okay.
I think they were just running through the country first. Mm-hmm. And so we all had this early, like 1978 version, 77, 78 version of home box office. And of course, you know, they played the same, four or five movies over and over and over. So as kids, we would rush home to school and we would watch, you know, I don't know, Flash Gordon 100 times. We would perform Flash Gordon. And so it is interesting to me how, like, there's a comfort in that kind of cinematic storytelling. Mm-hmm. And that is finding its way into in a lot of the work that I do as well.
Right. And with Jennifer, we're talking, of course, about a piece called A Woman with Eyes Closed, that's for Opera Philadelphia. Now, Jennifer told me that it was postponed because of COVID.
It sure was.
Does it have a new premiere date?
They are assessing that at present. Uh-huh. They have definitely
so
confirmed it is going to happen.
Excellent.
It'll be interesting to see how it happens.
And it also, the thing that I've been reading about this piece that I think is so interesting is that it has three possible endings.
It does.
So you're going a little also into Jennifer's idea. The Edwin Drood.
Yes. Why not?
Avenue. Yeah, why not? Is it completely finished? You know how that will work?
It is. It is completely finished. I think they're still kind of deciding how they might want to lay it out night to night. But yeah, that is definitely the intention.
Fantastic. I mean, it's so curious. I'm now. It's like makes me want to go to Philadelphia and see it.
You should. You should.
Yeah, I hope festival, I can.
that festival in Philly is just. I love what they're doing.
Yeah.
I love what they're doing.
Yeah. David Devan's doing fantastic work up there.
Yeah, that whole team over there, they're just exceptional.
Yep. So in an interview, this is a little bit of a departure from what we've been talking about, but in an interview you said, and I'm going to quote you, opera right now is at a huge turning point. Opera in America, at least, is trying to figure out what it wants to be and what it needs to become and what it needs to do. Now, of course, you wrote this in 2018. And if opera in America was at a turning point then, it may just be like standing on a cliff right now. But what do you think opera needs to do to move forward in the wake of this tumultuous year? What story should opera be telling? Whose story should opera be telling? Give me your thoughts on where you think this medium should go.
Here's an anecdote.
Sure.
I was working on one of these song projects and we were interviewing a singer, right? And this singer in his interview wanted to talk about his life, right? Because that's what we were doing.
Sure.
And he said, you know, you know, what do you want people to know about you? And he said, you know, he said, I'm Black, I'm gay, and I'm a Christian. Mm-hmm. And I said, talk to me about that. And so we had this wonderful conversation unfolding about that. And of course, a singer as well. And I said, have you, as a Black gay Christian, ever been on stage playing a character or singing a song, any song, about being a Black gay Christian? And he said, no. Hmm. And I said, well, guess what? We're about to do that. And first of all, it's shocking that we don't have that. Yeah. And it's also this kind of amazing blessing that this is where we are. Everyone is being resourceful. Everyone's digging deep and looking to their right and to their left, mm-hmm. and seeing who's there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's an amazing opportunity to rethink how we do things and what stories end up making it to the big stage, you know? Mm-hmm. And luckily there are all these wonderful companies right now that are, you know, certainly right before COVID, that are taking those risks and, you know, and figuring out how to make that happen, at least by degrees, you know?
Well, yeah, exactly. And I'm just so hoping that COVID doesn't scare people back a little bit. You know, I hope.
Yeah,
actually,
I know.
Like, it gives me hope to see how much innovation I'm seeing just within this whole crisis that we're in. Makes me hope that on the other side of it, in the new reality that we will all face here soon, that those innovations will continue, and that we'll see the value of telling everyone's stories. But it remains to be seen, I would think.
Definitely.
What stories are you interested in telling? Do you have a list of stuff that you, or do you just come to you?
I have, you know, I have a file on my computer.
Of course,
but it's so funny. Like, because you know I think you know this world well enough to know you know what those proposals and make a pitch, make a proposal, yeah. Have an idea, get a grant. So like I have my file of ideas that I have connected to all my peeps. And but there tends to be a theme through all of them. And that is, for me personally, I love the place that realism meets something other. And it probably, again, back to my religious upbringing, and
sure,
but I'm a fan of mystery.
Yeah.
And in the truest sense. And I really quite love what the human voice can do, uh-huh. around that. The opera voice can capture that that metaphysical space like nothing else can. So I love the place where that bumps into you know, just straightforward, good, solid narrative. Uh-huh. So, you know, you could call it magical realism, certainly, but it's definitely my, I'm addicted to that, certainly.
Your milieu. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah, it's...
Because my life, that's what my life feels like.
Right?
That's what my life feels like. I don't know about you, but right. I tend to walk around thinking I know what's going on. Uh-huh. And suddenly there is mystery, and I am either brought to my knees or lifted up. And I, you know, the scale of it. Uh-huh. And I think, and I know that opera does that. I know, you know, because I've sat in that audience, yeah. and yeah. watched it happen. I know that opera can do that. Unlike any other art form.
Yeah.
And as a librettist, I feel like I'm in a very pretty unique position, because I'm kind of got one foot here with my composer, uh-huh. but I am also the bridge to the director and the designer,
right.
You know, and that to me is so exciting. So I get to, as an artist, I also get to employ all of these crazy wackadoos skill sets that I've been
right.
forced to acquire by circumstance.
Right.
So I am kind of, in a way, being an actor, and I am getting to be a director, uh-huh. and I am getting to be a designer, uh-huh. and I'm getting to kind of like share a vision with a bunch of people mm-hmm. at the same time, you know. Mm-hmm. So
it's a continuation of your vagabond lifestyle.
There you go.
Art. Yeah.
There you go.
That's great.
Yeah, I grew up on movie sets, and yep. I grew up on, you know, I grew up around theater. I've been a little theater mouse my whole life.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, it all works for the greater good, I think.
Definitely. Jerry Dye, thank you so much for talking to me today. This was a really fun conversation, and it was nice to
Oh my goodness,
more about
it was
you.
Wonderful. I needed this.
Good.
Many thanks to Jerry for speaking with me. Next week is the penultimate episode of my first season. I can't quite believe that. A conversation with British director and writer Anna Poole about how she creates total art experiences by coming at her work from several disciplines. Don't miss it. In the meantime, thank you for listening. I'm Katora Stickan. This podcast was recorded deep inside my office closet in Knoxville, Tennessee. Special thanks to Aurélie Doucet for the colorful logo, Eileen Downey for the theme music, and my husband for keeping the dog quiet. Thanks for listening, and until the next time, stay safe, wear your mask, and keep telling stories.